From WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is one that too often doesn't get made the way it should. The connection between children and the money that's needed to help meet their basic needs. Nearly 3 million New Yorkers are living in poverty. Almost 900,000 of them our children. And there are some new efforts underway now to try to fix that problem. And in particular, the Child Poverty Reduction Act. That is the topic of this hour on Connections. It has passed both the Assembly and the State Senate. It is now on its way soon to Governor Cuomo's desk. And we will talk this hour about where it goes from here with some of its sponsors and advocates. Joining me by phone this hour is Assemblymember Harry Bronson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott, for having me on the show.
So glad to have you here. In studio with me, Larry Marks is the CEO of the Children's Agenda. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Get up close to the mic there.
Thank you. <laughs> you can
pull it closer to you. We don't fight. And Aqua Porter is on the phone, Executive Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Just barely afternoon, but we're there unless you're listening to the podcast later on, in which case it could be any time. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us, and we welcome your questions and thoughts, too. You can reach out by phone at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I'm on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. Happy to hear from you either way. Harry Bronson, let's start with you. You have been one of the people pushing for this, and this, you know, assuming that it gets to the governor's signature and becomes law, it will make New York the first state in the nation with a law pushing towards this goal of cutting the child poverty rate in half within 10 years. Talk to me a little bit about the historic nature of this and about the process and the road that you've taken to get to this point.
Yeah, Scott, certainly as your listeners are well aware, here in the Rochester area, 50% of our children live in poverty. At any given day, there's roughly 2,800 students of the Rochester City School District who are homeless. Those numbers are alarming, and indeed, New York children are more likely to live in poverty than other children in 32 other states. We have a serious problem in New York State regarding child poverty and the impacts of that, first of all, on any young child is a tragedy. But it's bigger from the standpoint that every day that we fail to prioritize ending poverty levels, we are setting a foundation for generational poverty. And that impacts, in particular, people of color. And we have to address this. We have to address it because, you know, the children deserve nothing less.
There certainly have been attempts. I referenced this in the recorded intro to the show earlier. You know, there have been a long list of legislative attempts, both at the state level and federally, to try to do something about child poverty. What do you hope is going to make this succeed in ways perhaps that some of these efforts have not in the past?
So for me, I think it's the structure of the legislation that we're putting in place. First of all, we're involving all agencies across the state that have some that touch children in some way and touch poverty in some way. In addition, we're involving the experts like the Children's Agenda and others to be part of the process. And first of all, there's a public commitment to cut child poverty in half in 10 years. That commitment is important, so we have a goal in place. Second, we require an annual analysis of the state budget to see what will the impact on child poverty be in the investments we're making in that state budget. A Child Poverty Reduction Advisory Council will oversee all of this. We'll set benchmarks and to make sure that as we go through and we do budget cycles, we do legislative cycles, are we meeting those benchmarks? And a key component of that is racial equity. And then lastly, there'll be regular reporting to hold government accountable and to make sure that we're evaluating our funding investments, evaluating our policy approaches, and making sure that we're taking the steps so we can meet that goal at the end of 10 years.
Where did that goal originate, both in terms of the time frame and in terms of that number of reducing the rate specifically by half?
Yeah, I think Larry should jump in here because the Children's Agenda brought this issue to me, and they're the experts in the field. And I, you know, my sense is we wanted to have a goal that was doable and realistic, but at that same time was aggressive in the reduction of child poverty. But I think Larry might be able to answer that better.
Larry Marks, the Children Agenda, have at it.
Sure. Well, the whole point of it is to add urgency to an issue that otherwise is on a low flame and back burner when it comes to government priorities. No less than an authority than Martin Luther King once said, poverty should not be accepted as a necessary evil or insoluble problem, but should be considered a crisis requiring emergency measures. It's a matter of will and priorities, not a matter of resources. So the whole point of this is to establish a timeline, to establish a metric, and to create the political will necessary to start moving the resources that can really make a difference.
In terms of that political will, I want to go back to Harry Bronson here to get just a quick update on where we are with the nuts and bolts of this. It made its way through both the Assembly and the Senate before the end of the session. Where are things now in terms of getting it on the governor's desk, and what is your expectation as far as whether or not it's going to get that signature and become law?
So regarding the political will, the very positive aspect of this is it has bipartisan support in terms of both Republican and Democrats signing on as co-sponsors. And second, a supermajority of legislators, both in the Assembly and in the Senate, voted in favor of this measure. So it goes to the governor's desk with very strong support from the legislature. Second of all, I've had conversations with the administration, and they certainly recognize this crisis. And so we're very hopeful, especially since we're involving through the council the various state agencies that can have an impact on child poverty. We're very hopeful that the governor is going to see this favorably and sign it into law once it gets delivered to his desk.
Which will happen when, do you think?
So the process works with whichever house passes the bill first has control in delivering the bill. So the Senate passed it the day before the Assembly did. So the Senate will be in charge and in control of delivering the bill to the governor. Usually, we work with the governor's office so that there's a regular flow of bills that go to the governor, and that works with their workforce with various counselors that have to review them from a legal standpoint and things of that nature. So there'll be discussions back and forth between the Senate and the governor to determine the when. My expectation is it will probably happen sometime midsummer.
Okay, so before you're back in session this this fall, then. I want to turn now, as we continue our conversation here on Connections, with Assemblymember Harry Bronson, with Larry Marks, CEO of the Children's Agenda, and also on the phone with us is Aqua Porter, the Executive Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. You, as Larry does, you're really kind of living the fight to make this happen. What are you hopeful for here? What resources are you hoping to get here that perhaps you've needed all along and not been able to muster in this fight?
Thank you for the question, and thank you for the invitation to join this discussion today. The resources that I think we need are, funding and money to poor families. At the end of the day, we know that poor children are in households with poor parents, and until we're able to meet the basic needs of the families, then those children are going to continue to languish in poor households. And poor children have likely have worse academic achievement. They potentially drop out of high school. They are likely to become unemployed. They experience more economic hardships into adulthood. So stemming the tide and ensuring that we don't grow poor children into poor adults that impact our economies in our local communities, I think is really important. And so the focus and the attention to not to pay attention to poor children is one of the most important things I think we can do as a community. And I really applaud Larry and Harry for the work that they have done to move the needle on this.
And it's no mystery what it takes to lift half of the children out of poverty. The Congress ordered the largest and biggest researched report ever on childhood poverty back that was released in 2019 by the National Academy of Sciences. And it estimated that child poverty costs us $800 billion to $1.1 trillion every year. And it concluded that there are some public policies that would, to Aqua's point, put money in the pockets of poor families and make a humongous difference. And that's a suite of public policies, including the earned income tax credit, increasing the refundability of the child tax credit, what the Biden administration has done, at least during this emergency period with the pandemic, and a publicly funded minimum child support payment for single parents. So that suite of policies are actually what are in Assemblymember Bronson's bill to be examined and hopefully to be implemented down the road by the state to achieve that goal. So those are public policy solutions, but we can't do this piecemeal. It has to be done through the will of the public, which is best exercised through government.
You'd mentioned on that federal level, and we have seen some of these changes now in federal tax policy. We had the announcement just a few days ago from the Biden administration kind of emphasizing that, you know, if you're below a certain relatively high income level, that you're going to start seeing these checks or these direct deposits coming for the child tax credit. That's, what, $250, I think, for kids over a certain age and $500 a month if they're below six. Is this by itself, I know we're getting a little bit from state into federal here, but it all goes into the same pockets in the end. How helpful is that? A friend of mine described it at one point as, hey, this is almost like universal basic income for parents, which has obviously been one goal that has yet to be achieved on a lot of the progressive side of things, both federally and statewide. How much of a good thing is this? How much can simply just giving parents a little bit extra money a month, how much can that do just by itself to help get them out of these states that they're in?
Yeah, there's an institute on poverty research at Columbia University that analyzed the changes the Biden administration was making in the child tax credit. And by the way, it's a lot more generous, at least during this emergency period. It's something like $3,000 a year. For children over a certain age and $3,600 for children under a certain age. And again, that's only during the next year. But the researchers showed that it is likely itself that just that one change to reduce poverty in half for children in the country over the next year. That's hundreds of thousands of children whose futures will be altered inexorably as a result of just that one minor tax code change. So, of course, there's an effort in Congress now to make that a permanent change, and it's what is best going to help families living in poverty with children.
I know even as somebody who's not living anywhere near poverty, as a comfortable middle-class parent, I'm looking forward to getting that little bit extra for my kid. It, you know, every little bit helps. Certainly, Aqua, from the point of view of somebody, you know, of somebody who's trying to make ends meet from month to month, what kind of difference can an extra couple hundred or $500 a month make to them?
Parents tell us that it gives them breathing room, right? It allows them not to be stressed out about whether they're going to be able to feed their children, whether they're going to be able to get them from home to school to work, whether they have a little bit more freedom in what they're able to provide regarding just their basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, childcare. So transportation, like the things that we all take for granted in some cases when we are families of means, are extraordinarily harder for poor people. Like poverty just, it costs so much to be poor that we take away so many resources, we make everything harder. And so money coming in allows families to make decisions on where they see the biggest need for their families and to direct the resources there. That is a big stress relief off parents who are doing this day in and day out, just trying to get basic needs for their families met.
It's Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about child poverty and about a new effort to try to lift more New Yorkers out of child poverty and reduce that rate by half within 10 years. We are talking with one of the sponsors of this bill that has passed now in both houses of the state legislature. Assemblymember Harry Bronson is with us. Larry Marks, the CEO of the Children's Agenda, in studio with us. And Aqua Porter on the phone is the executive director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. And Aqua, you made that excellent point that it costs money to be poor. I want you to expand on that a little bit, because all of these things that perhaps you don't think about that are easy to do if you live in the suburbs, if you have a working car that makes it easy to get to doctor's appointments, if you have the kind of job that allows you the flexibility to go away for 2 hours to take your kid to a doctor's appointment, all of these things that many of us kind of take for granted, a lot of us can't take for granted, right?
Correct. There are families, there are parents who are piecing together multiple jobs. They may have to go from job A to job B to job C, not be able to spend time with their children, try to figure out how to get their children taken care of while they're, moving between jobs, how to get their kids fed while they're moving between jobs, how to try to be an attentive parent. Like, all of those things takes time. Time is money. If I only had one job that paid me enough so that I could spend quality time with my family, then I would have more personal flexibility, and it would cost me less to be able to try to move between those jobs. So, the things that a lot of us really do take for granted, these working, hardworking families who are poor are doubly impacted or triply impacted. Everything is harder, like walking. I talked to a mom. I tell this story a lot. I talked to a mom who had two children, and she was interviewing for a job to be a CNA, kind of a certified nurse's assistant. And her preference was to work in the evenings and on weekends and holidays, because those hours gave her an additional benefit, right? You got a little bit of a bonus pay for working those hours. But she would have to leave her kids. Her kids were like 5 and 7. And so her decision was to tuck her kids in to bed, leave the house, leave them with a cell phone, go to work the third shift, come back home in the morning, get her kids dressed for school, get the kids to school. Right? Those are heartbreaking decisions that parents have to make. Right? That's heartbreaking.
Go ahead.
Right. So do we judge her for being a bad parent? She was trying to be the most responsible parent to provide her kids with basic needs, but she made a decision that we would want nobody to have to make.
And then to add into that, you hear the stories of people who then start getting into cycles of having cars that have parking tickets that can't get paid, and those fees build up.
Correct.
In the pandemic too, and I want to get to this point just before we get to our break here. We're coming off what has obviously been a very unusual year for many of us, and that has strained the resources of even those of us with a lot of resources. And turn back to you, Harry Bronson, first. What are some of the effects that you've seen specifically from the pandemic that you're hoping perhaps can also be addressed by this legislation?
Well, we certainly saw in the pandemic that parents were being asked to be remote educators, and at the same time, they might be remote workers, or for many who are working poor with low-wage jobs, they're in service industries where they were still required to go to work. And balancing in ordinary times is very difficult for these families, as Aqua just pointed out. Trying to do that when you have to address all of the restrictions that we had during the pandemic just created a heightened burden. In addition, we know poverty has an adverse impact on a child's academic performance. So add to it that they're not in school. Maybe school's the only place they were getting a healthy meal a day. And all those kind of safety nets that education provided pre-COVID were not necessarily there during COVID. And these, you know, the important part here, I think, is, as was said previously, one approach is not going to fix this problem. We have to look at every area. We have to look at how do we make sure that the working poor can get better paying jobs? How do we ensure that they can get benefits through those jobs? What would be the training and workforce development programs that will help? How do we subsidize housing? How do we make sure that transportation is there? How do we subsidize childcare? We have to look at all of this in a comprehensive way. COVID, I think, helped us address or look at things a little bit differently. So there's some benefits in that regard. But the beauty of this advisory council is they're going to be looking at all these areas in a comprehensive way.
Larry Marksman, you've got one point, and then we got to get to a break here.
Sure. So. I'll just add that during the pandemic, it's well known that over 2 million women dropped out of the workforce nationally. And the reason why they did that, of course, was to take care of children who were no longer in school or no longer in childcare. In fact, compared to most other countries around the world, it's been said that the United States doesn't have a social safety net. We have women. So mothers and wives and family are who takes care of kids and others in family. And it's the lack of a child care system, which was in crisis before the pandemic, but was completely exposed to be incomplete and ineffective during the pandemic, is what's really hurting us right now and hurting women getting back into the workforce and hurting family income.
So much more to talk about here with our guests, Assemblymember Harry Bronson, Larry Marks from the Children's Agenda, and Aqua Porter of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, and you as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. We'll get some of your calls as well after we get to our break. But before we get to our break, it is also Summer Book Week here on Connections. We have been talking with a lot of prominent Rochesterians about what they have been reading this summer. And among the conversations that I have had this week, I got to sit down recently with Assemblymember Marjorie Burns.
Well, this summer I found a book at the Avon Library called Walking Seasonal Roads by Mary Hood. And it is literally about walking seasonal roads in Steuben County. And seasonal roads, for those in a more metropolitan area, are a lot of dirt roads that are still in a lot of our rural areas that connect farms to each other and a few houses, but are less traveled than your normal highways and byways.
No maintenance December to April.
That's
no
correct.
Signs driving around.
That
absolutely.
Is correct. Yep. Also called usually seasonal use only.
Yep.
And I saw it at the Avon Library, and it interested me for a couple of reasons. First, I do represent part of Steuben County. And also, Ms. Hood is an environmentalist, conservationist, and is very concerned about the environment and obviously its effects on our entire world. And for this purpose, for our local areas, including Steuben County. And what attracted me to it is she started out with a dichotomy of what it's like with main highways and thoroughfares, and then wanted to talk, though, about the seasonal roads, those less traveled roads, which she called basically the good roads. and for a number of reasons that if you ever choose to read the book, you'll see. And I found it very fascinating because she is very concerned about ensuring that we do everything we can to keep some of the areas that are still less traveled, maybe not total woodlands, but at least less traveled areas, because she feels very strongly in the importance of caring about the environment, but also the fact that walking down these roads and exploring these areas takes you back to nature and really fulfills us as human beings when we can see the world as it used to be, or in the less rural areas, or in the more rural areas the way it is. And I really did find it fascinating, and obviously the concern also, though, as she points out, about coming across plastic bottles and cans when even you're even someplace that they shouldn't be. They shouldn't be anywhere. But, I mean, especially in areas that are not inhabited, and all of a sudden you come across garbage and debris.
Absolutely. And your other choice here?
Oh, the other choice I have is August Gale. And this is a book that I actually had read back in a while ago up in Maine. As many of you know, I grew up in the city of Rochester, not far away from Ontario Beach Park. And in the summer, I would always see all the electrical storms going on over the lake. And I've always been fascinated by water, both at the Great Lakes and when I go to Maine, usually once in the summer to the Maine coast. And I spent a lot of time reading books about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes or in the ocean. They've always fascinated me. And this particular book, which really comes out of the state of Maine, is one I bought there while I was sitting at the edge of the ocean to read during a vacation a couple of years ago. And it's called August Gale by Barbara Walsh. And these are both phenomenal books, and they're some of the things I care about that I'm interested in. I do a lot of reading at work. So when I have time off to actually kick my feet up and read, I read for enjoyment. And that's why I tend to go back to the things that are dearest to me. Having grown up in Shalott, you know, where our high school was the Lakers,
mm-hmm.
You know, and everywhere else, and lighthouses, and, you know, right by the Genesee Lighthouse is where I grew up. You know, these things were always very important to me and left very deep roots in my heart. So when I can, I love to read those types of books as well.
Sounds like a great summer reading list. Assemblywoman Marjorie Burns, thank you so much for coming in. And we will continue with Connections right after this short break. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. And we will actually be back with the second hour with more of Summer Book Week. We'll be talking about young adult and kids books with a panel of authors and local readers and booksellers and librarians. It's going to be a great finale to Summer Book Week. Stay with us. That's coming up in the next hour. But right now we are talking about child poverty and about the new Child Poverty Reduction Act that is on its way to Governor Cuomo's desk, hopefully for a signature before the end of the summer. We are talking with Assemblymember Harry Bronson with us on the phone. We have Larry Marks in studio, the CEO of the Children's Agenda. We have Aqua Porter, the executive director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. And we have you at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Want to go to the phones. David from California has been waiting. David, you got a question about economic education.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Scott. The time value of money is something that's very important. And I was hoping that there would be some sort of an education platform for kids to understand how money changes, the value of money changes. Of course, a simple way to think about it is, you know, if you buy some penny candy and all of a sudden it's $2.50, you know, how much change has there also been in the cost of car tires or in heating gas or whatnot? So just to give a comparison, I'm baby boom. And when I was a kid, when I was just hitting the work market, it took you 20 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold. Today, it takes you 245 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold. And instead of $1.60 being the minimum wage, if we were to divide the ounce of gold by 20, you would end up with an $88 an hour minimum wage. So if kids are not educated in time value of money, they are going to be cheated and cheated and cheated for decades to come.
A fascinating question. Thanks for calling, David. It speaks also, I think, to this larger question about where we are with minimum wage. And Aqua, I want to get straight to you because one of your goals, your initiative has been to get, 10,000 local employers who are paying a $15 minimum wage. Where do you stand with that? And give me some thoughts on how to teach kids about an economy that they may or may not be able to completely participate in from where they're coming from.
Well, thank you. And let's just go back to some of the conversations we had earlier, which are that at the end of the day, people want to be able to afford their basic needs. And it is my fervent belief that anybody who works 40 hours a week or full time should be able to cover their basic needs with their income. And that is not the case if we have incomes that really do not pay a living wage. So this $15 an hour minimum wage push that our MAPI is advocating has been really successful so far. Our goal is to get to 10,000 residents lifted to a minimum of $15 an hour. To date, we're at about 5,600. We've already counted about 5,600 employees in our region, our Monroe County and Rochester region, that will see their wages raised to $15. And what that doesn't include, and what I'm really excited about, is what I call the benefit collateral, the collateral benefit of that, which is that in many cases, employers are saying, hey, we have a number of employees that are at $15 or right around $15. And as we move our employees minimum to 15, we're also going to raise the wages of those at 15 so that we don't have this constriction there. So they are addressing that. And so many more employees in our region are seeing their wages being lifted, which I think is terrific. We hope that that momentum continues. We're looking for employers to really think about what the impact on our community could be when wages are lifted and the community benefits, because people can now afford to buy and pay for the basic needs that they need in order to survive.
Harry Bronson, I want to go to you on the legislative side of this, because we're still not all the way there. I know there's this step process to get New York to a higher minimum wage, and we haven't worked our way all through those steps upstate. Where are we as far as Albany goes? Is there any momentum to get beyond 15 ultimately from Albany?
Well, the momentum, yes, there is from this standpoint. First of all, in upstate, we're only at $12.50 an hour. There will be a review by the Department of Labor and a report put out regarding where is the economy, what has been the impact of the minimum wage on the economy in upstate, and with recommendation to hopefully, and from my standpoint, a recommendation that we actually go forward to a full $15 an hour. That being said, there's a bill that I am co-sponsoring. It is sponsored by the chair of the Assembly's Labor Committee, which would index the minimum wage. And what that means is that instead of having this political battle whether to raise the minimum wage or not, periodically, usually about every 10 years, the minimum wage would be indexed to the consumer price index. And so as prices go up, as the cost of living goes up by a particular percentage, so will the minimum wage. This is good for the employees because they stay at least at the base level of paying for the cost of goods that they have to survive and provide for their families. It's also good for employers because the employers can plan. And instead of having a huge increase every decade or so, employers are going to be monitoring the consumer price index, and they're going to know what is going to be their added labor costs through wages. So I'm very hopeful that bill makes it through the legislative session as we go back into session in January.
Are we seeing here, and I realize that we're straying from the specific topic of childhood poverty, but with good reason, because as Larry and I were discussing during the break, it's part of a much larger set of economic systems, of ongoing community history with redlining and with racism and equity. But are we seeing, has the pandemic to some extent, do you think, kind of forced the hand of workers and kind of forced employers to realize that if they're going to be able to get employees right now, they've got to be paying? I mean, when I go around town, I'm seeing more and more places that are saying we're starting at 15 or even more because they know they have to in order to attract the employees they need to keep their business going.
Yeah, there certainly is a worker shortage from the standpoint that, as was mentioned previously, some workers still aren't ready to go back to full employment because of childcare and things of that nature. But, you know, there are, especially in the service industry, folks who are looking for employees. So when that gets competitive, where there's a worker shortage, if you will, then that usually requires employers to offer higher wages or benefits, more flexibility in the hours, things of that nature as incentives for workers to come to their location. The other asset you just mentioned, you know, the redlining, another piece of this and somewhat aligned with the questioner is that it's really important that we help families understand how to budget, do monthly budgets and yearly budgets so they know what the costs are. We have to make sure families understand, you know, what does compounding interest mean, and how does that, when you are purchasing things on your credit card, what does that really translate in how it is burdening your monthly income and your ability to pay for your necessities? What does it mean to be able to have a good credit score so that you can get into home ownership? And this is especially important as we also try not only to address poverty, but to address racism and the structural racism that has occurred historically, such as redlining, so that we can get families of color into purchasing homes, which then translates into creating assets for the family that ultimately can be passed on to other generations. So all of those kind of things are issues that the council will be looking into.
At a time on top of that when we have a huge shortage of available homes for sale too. Larry, you want to jump in here?
Well, I do want to agree with the caller that education is important to lifting people out of poverty. It's also true that lifting people out of poverty is important to education. And that's why I think there's urgency focusing again on children, and particularly the youngest children. If you're under four, you are far more likely to live in poverty in this country than if you're older. And just in terms of the way that poverty determines educational impact and lifelong health is amazing. That brain development, there are millions of neural connections made a second when you're before you hit kindergarten, and that speaks to things like self-regulation, that speaks to attention, impulsivity, it gets into language development. But just on a sheer physical health level, maternal and infant mortality is so much more likely when a family is in poverty. Their child is more likely to be born at low birth weight, which is determinative of a number of health impacts down the road, including chronic illness and nutrition and likelihood of injuries. So I think it's really important to focus on particularly little kids who are so incredibly malleable and still developing bodies, minds, that it's inexcusable to let those kids develop in an environment of poverty. And that's going to have a much bigger impact on what a child learns than 17-year-old, say, learning about buying a house or balancing a checkbook.
That's not important, too.
Not that it's not important, right.
A lot to tackle here, here on Connections from WXXI News. We are talking with Assemblymember Harry Bronson of the 138th District, Larry Marks, the CEO of the Children's Agenda, and Aqua Porter, the Executive Director of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Harry Bronson, you had mentioned this council, and I want to, in the remaining 9 minutes or so that we have, I want to just dig into this a little bit deeper. So one of the things, assuming that the bill gets the governor's signature and becomes law, there will be this advisory council that will be a key part of this. Explain to me how this is going to work, and you know, for people who will look at this and say, oh, good, we have another council, we have another committee, there will be more reports. What do you hope is actually going to change as a result of this council?
Well, I think the significant piece of this, as we've mentioned several times, is the comprehensive approach that we have the goal set. There will be benchmarks. We will be monitoring to see if we're making the funding investments as well as the policy investments to reach our goal of reducing poverty by 50% in 10 years. The council is unique in that it is going to be made up of representatives from the Temporary and Disability Assistance Agency. It will include folks from Children and Family Services. It will include the New York State Council of Children and Families. It will include the Department of Taxation and Finance. The Economic Development Council will be represented, and nonprofit poverty advocacy organizations such as the Children's Agenda will be involved in this. So we're pulling from the various sectors of government that can have a positive impact on child poverty.
And also, and people living in poverty, too, are a part of the council.
Exactly, Larry. And the last part is to make sure that we have folks who have lived through and are currently living in poverty. So we're hearing the voices of the people that we want to serve.
How do you recruit them? How are they going to become a part of this?
Well, we have some learning on that, some experience on that, I should say, with the Rochester Monroe County Anti-Poverty Initiative, which I participated a number of years ago in the work groups. We made sure that we had representatives, and we recruited representatives from the community of poverty. And my own personal experience, I was on the Workforce Development Committee. I can't remember if that was the exact name. But as we were going through the exercises, it became very clear that some folks who are more accustomed to those group kind of activities were dominating. And even though we had brought people living in poverty to the discussion, through the exercise, we were realizing that their voices really weren't being heard. So there was an adjustment made during that process to make sure that we checked ourselves each time to make sure the voices of people living in poverty were being heard and recognized. And, that personal experience, we certainly were able to do that. And I know Aqua and her team are still doing that and constantly are communicating with people living in poverty to see what their needs are and see, what their thoughts are on how we can meet those needs. The vision of this council will be the same.
Aqua, what are your plans for making sure that these voices do get heard?
Yeah, so Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, our MAPI, we are anchored on making sure and ensuring that people with lived experience are a part of the entire process from, the initializing of a concept of an idea all the way through implementation of a program or an action. And so we do things like create cohorts of community members with lived experience who have specific knowledge or experience in an area. Today we have a single mother's cohort. We have a frontline workers cohort. We are building a a cohort that includes young people, 18 to 25, so that we're able to really address individual and specific concerns and needs and bring that voice to the table of decision makers who include the community members as we start to do the work. That is proven to build trust, to share experiences, and to let people kind of understand how they may experience or the assumptions that they might have about how other people live or are experiencing things may be different from their own, and allow them to kind of look at solutions and co-create in a space of understanding and create that shared understanding and ways to move forward.
Okay, we've got time for one more quick call. We go to Michael from Fairport. We've got about a minute left for your call here on Connections, Michael.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. It's very frustrating to listen to this conversation, and it's not just the people there today, but I've heard these kind of conversations about anti-poverty programs going back more than 30 years here in Rochester. And I don't think anything's changed. And I don't think that the government and politicians can legislate anything to do away with poverty. And I think they're missing the point. There's all, when they have a goal, 10 years, we're going to reduce poverty by this percentage and that percentage. It's been going on for years and years and years. And no disrespect to these people, because I know there's good organizations that are trying. But what I wanted to talk about is what I think could actually do something. And that's, if you take a look at in Rochester, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Rochester, an organization like that, now there's you know, only a certain size, they can handle over 400 kids, I think, in total. So that's a small percentage. But, you know, they take kids at that age, at a certain age, when they're young, and they have programs there. It's very, very impressive. They have a literacy program. They have all sorts of programs that keep these kids out of gangs. They keep these kids in school and doing well. They get these kids into college. I know one of them I met who was a member there, and a year or two ago graduated with a degree in finance from the University of Rochester.
It's an excellent point, Michael. I don't want to have to cut you off, but I want to give our guests a moment to respond to that, and I appreciate the call. And I apologize, we come up so fast on the end of the hour here. But I want to actually bring that back around to Larry, because it goes to his point that if you address these issues, the earlier you can address them, that the fewer problems you have down the road. And I also want to give you a chance, too, because you had mentioned during the break that you are optimistic that this time things are happening.
Well, just to agree with the caller that we need all hands on deck when it comes to changing circumstances. And the Boys and Girls Club are just wonderful jewels in the crown of what makes Rochester such a special place. But they're not able to the caller's central point, they're not able to do it alone. And they're not able to make the changes that are necessary alone. The experience and evidence shows that when there is a commitment like Social Security, the number one population in this country that used to live in poverty were senior citizens. But over the years from 1935 to 2000, that's been reduced to less than 15% of the senior citizen population living in poverty, thanks to a national commitment like Social Security. The same is possible for this population, talking about children. And that's what it takes. It takes all hands on deck. It takes children's service organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs. And it's going to take government policy on a mass scale to reach that kind of scale and sustainability that's necessary to make a huge dent in the problem. To the caller's point, we haven't seen that commitment ever. And now we're just beginning to see it. So when we have a president that introduces a $3,000 a year refundable tax credit for families with children of a certain age, or $3,600 a year under that age, that is proven to make a huge difference.
And here we are already at the end of the hour. It goes by very quickly. My thanks to our guests, Assemblymember Harry Bronson of the 138th District, a co-sponsor of the Childhood Poverty Reduction Act. Aqua Porter, Executive Director of RMAPI, the Rochester-Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. And Larry Marks, CEO of the Children's Agenda. Thank you all for being with us here on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. We continue with more Summer Book Week just ahead. Our thanks, as always, to executive producer Megan Mack, producer Emma Ray Stein, and Rob Braden behind the board, reminding me to stop clicking this noisy pen on the air. We'll be back with more Connections in just a moment.